Brexit, you've got a handle on, right? British exit from the European Union. Brexit? Yeah, well, hang on. We got another one for you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 9th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody, with the stipulation that, yes, we did fight a revolution so we wouldn't have to pay attention to the British Parliament. Sometimes it's just fun to listen to.
Mr. Speaker, how can anyone have faith in the Prime Minister getting a good deal with 27 European Union governments when she can't even broker a deal within her own cabinet?
This has not been the best of 24 hours for British Prime Minister Theresa May. That was Jeremy Corbyn there, her wannabe successor, the leader of Britain's Labour Party, today milking May's recent troubles over how exactly the UK is going to get itself out of the European Union. Yesterday, David Davis, the Brexit minister, resigned. Today, it was Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary. So we got Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the line from London to walk us through what is going on over there. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
For our purposes here about Brexit, which is a bigger deal? Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, leaving, or David Davis, the Brexit minister, saying he's had enough?
I would say Boris, probably, but both, really. It's the combination, two cabinet ministers in one go. Right. It's a bit of a blow to the authority of Theresa May, no doubt about it.
All right, so the operative phrases here that I think we need to remind folks of are soft Brexit and hard Brexit. Elaborate on that, would you?
Okay. Well, let me introduce a new term, Brino.
I don't even know what that is. Brino? What is
okay,
that?
Okay. So we've got a new acronym to deal with, Brino. It stands for Brexit in name only.
Oh.
And David Davis and Boris Johnson have quit because they say May's plan does not represent the Brexit that 17.4 million Brits voted for 2 years ago. It is, in fact, Brexit in name only because it keeps the UK, in their view, too closely aligned with EU regulations, subject to the European Court of Justice, unable to strike its own free trade deals with countries like the US. Mm. And yet, since it would still be outside the EU and wouldn't have a say in EU trade policy or EU regulations, Boris Johnson, in his resignation letter, said this plan would lead to Britain becoming a colony of the EU, given Britain's imperial past. A rather ironic fate.
So about the EU then, there are, I think, what's it till March? Like 7-8 months left until this is officially supposed to be done and taken care of. What does this mean for negotiations with, by all accounts, Prime Minister May's cabinet and government on the brink?
Well, the timetable is very tight indeed. I mean, the UK's got to put this plan to its EU partners. It then has to be ratified by the UK Parliament and most of the parliaments of the 27 EU member states before the end of March. If it doesn't, there is the danger, at least, of a very hard Brexit indeed, the UK crashing out of the EU without a deal. And we've had in recent weeks a whole string of major corporations like Airbus, BMW, Jaguar Land Rover and so on, who employ between them tens of thousands of people, saying that if there is a hard Brexit, they may have to relocate. So there's a great deal at stake as the British government flounders.
Quickly at the end here then, what is the European Union saying with these latest developments over the weekend?
Not very much. They're keeping their heads down. They say this is a matter for the Brits. One suspects that privately they're very pleased as they watch Britain implode. It underlines for them the perils of daring to leave the EU. They shouldn't be too complacent, though. There's a lot at stake here for the EU. Germany sells 20% of its cars, 20% of its exports of cars to Britain. So they should pause before they gloat.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
One thing Stephen and I did not get to is the European trip that President Trump is about to make. He'll meet the Queen and Vladimir Putin, not at the same time, of course, but also he's going to attend a big NATO meeting in Brussels. And in advance, as he is wont to do ahead of these big multilateral meetings, he was tweeting in a not entirely friendly way about how NATO countries aren't spending enough on defense and that the United States is paying an unfair share. A couple of things about that. First of all, it's true that NATO members are supposed to spend 2% of their GDP on their military. It's also true that only about 8 of NATO's 29 members are going to do that this year, and a long line of American presidents have complained about it. But that does not mean that NATO is a bad deal for the United States, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Should other NATO members contribute more? Yes. But they are working on that, says Jeremy Shapiro at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Even so, is NATO still a good deal for the U.S.? Also yes, says Shapiro.
Twice in the 20th century, there were massive wars in Europe that absorbed an incredible amount of U.S. blood and treasure.
The lesson of those wars, one of the reasons for creating NATO, was the realization that a peaceful Europe is good for the U.S.
Investing in the stability of Europe has proven to be the single best investment that the United States has ever made.
It's hard to put a price on having allies. Heather Conley at the Center for Strategic and International Studies points to this part of NATO that says an attack against one ally is considered an attack against all allies.
The only time NATO has used this very important tool was because we were attacked on 9/11 and where the entire alliance worked with us in Afghanistan.
Mara Carlin at Johns Hopkins says NATO allies share other U.S. priorities, too, like the fight against ISIS.
When necessary, NATO has come together. It will be painful and bumpy, no doubt, but it has come together.
And there are more practical benefits, says Clementine Starling with the Atlantic Council.
European allies allow the U.S. to kind of use and have access to bases in Europe, medical facilities, essentially kind of forward stationing areas.
Bottom line, Starling says NATO makes sense for the U.S., even if much of the relationship can't be captured in dollars or euros. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
At the risk of repeating myself, traders on Wall Street care not a whit about your trade war. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember all those questions coming out of the AT&T purchase of Time Warner? The questions that went, a big pipeline company, that'd be AT&T, is taking over a bunch of content companies, Warner Brothers Studios, HBO. How's that going to work out for those companies and for consumers? Well, thanks to the New York Times this weekend, we now have a clue, more than a clue, really. The Times got its hands on a recording of a town hall meeting with the new head of Warner Media, John Stankey, and a bunch of, actually all, HBO employees. And all those AT&T pre-merger promises to keep its hands off HBO, they were perhaps less than ironclad, as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
HBO gave us The Wire, Game of Thrones, Sex and the City, and of course, The Sopranos.
HBO has basically set the tone for the last 20 years or so of television.
Alan Sepinwall is a TV critic for Rolling Stone. He says HBO's strength has always been quality over quantity. The pay cable network piled up Emmys and brought in billions of dollars for Time Warner over the years.
They were, for a very long time, the outfit that everybody else was chasing, everybody else was copying. Now it seems they've decided they're going to copy, you know, another competitor.
That competitor? Netflix, where it's definitely about quantity. Warner Media head John Stankey said in the town hall he wants to substantially increase the number of HBO subscribers, now roughly 140 million worldwide. And he wants them watching, quote, hours a day, end quote, not hours a week. It's all about the data, says James McQuivey, an analyst at Forrester Research.
More hours of viewing means we know our customer better, so we can develop the next 10 shows for that customer more effectively.
And have more to offer advertisers.
And all of that, of course, adds up to money.
Warner Media feels that however profitable HBO is, it's just simply not enough.
Paul Verna is an analyst at eMarketer. He says it'll be tough for HBO to scale, but
we live in a world where you have to do both. You have to do more and you have to do better.
Or as Stanky put it to HBO's employees, quote, "It's going to be a tough year." I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Sometimes when you're all science and ethics and money together, things get a little messy. There are possibly examples of that that are better known than the case of Henrietta Lacks, but probably not too many. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks was a best-selling book. It was also an HBO movie starring Oprah Winfrey. Cancer cells were taken from Lacks' body without her consent back in 1951, cells that have become among the most important in medical research. Something like 17,000 patents are associated with them. Conspicuously missing from some of the stories about the legacy of those cells, though, is that issue of money and who, in essence, is responsible for the cells. Attorney Christina Bostic is trying on behalf of one of Lacks' grandsons to change that by seeking legal guardianship of the cells. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why does this case matter to you?
You know, I am concerned about the exploitation of disenfranchised people in this country and how the law functions to disempower them from having a voice and from pursuing any concerns about their case. That's not the way America is supposed to work. You're supposed to be able to utilize the legal system to find justice. And so this was sort of right up my alley. It kind of just came to me that I should reach out to Ron Lacks, who's the grandson of Henrietta Lacks, and see if there was anything I could do to help.
We should say here, because it's important, you, on behalf of the family, don't seek ownership of the cells and the cell line, but rather guardianship. Explain that to me.
Yes, there is a some legal background that says you can't really own a cell or something that has been disposed of from your body. So I think it's more of an uphill battle to look at ownership of the cells or to try and patent a cell. And so a guardianship of the cell really says that the cell owns itself. The cell has rights. And so this is a question that's really unique. Is a cell, in and of itself, life?
Not to get cold-blooded about this, but there's millions, probably billions of dollars in patents and intellectual property and all kinds of things that have come from this cell line.
That's right. There are many steps to this process. This is a big case. It's very technical, very medical and scientific. And so some of those scientific aspects of things are going to have to be dealt with by experts. But my main concern is, how do we get this case into court? Because so far it hasn't had a day in court, right? And that's primarily because there's this thing called statute of limitations in the law. So you only get somewhere between 1 and maybe 10 years, depending on what the claim is, to file a lawsuit.
If you prevail and this goes the way you hope it goes for your clients, what does that look like?
Well, right now, like I said, we are pursuing a guardianship petition. So the first step is, how can I get the cells themselves to pursue a claim? Then the next step is to sue Johns Hopkins in particular.
Which is where Henrietta Lacks went in 1950-ish, right, to get this original treatment from which this cell line was derived.
That's exactly right. When her cells were taken and studied, the communications back and forth between her, the treatments, all of those things need to sort of be legally investigated. And so the next step is sort of going through what we call the discovery process to figure out what information is out there and if there are any other litigants that we need to pursue.
Hopkins, we should say, denies culpability here, right?
Yes, that is my understanding, that the statute of limitations has run. There should be no ability to file a claim against them, and that they did not take out a patent, which they weren't legally authorized to do, on the cell, so they haven't reaped a benefit. I think that that's a little black and white, and it's, whether or not there has been a profit here is something that needs some investigating.
Christina Bostic, attorney in Baltimore, Maryland, for the grandson, I guess, Ron Lacks, of Henrietta Lacks, of the book.
That's right.
And the movie. Christina, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up.
We get a lot of headlines on the month-to-month numbers. They don't matter as much.
Well, fine. But we're still going to do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 320 today, 1.3%, 24,776. Trade war, what trade war? NASDAQ up 67 points, 0.8%, 77.56. The S&P 500 gained 24 points, about 0.8%, 27.84. Banks did all right. J.P. Morgan Chase rang up 3%. Bank of America piled up 3.6%. Citigroup up 2.6%. Today, Helen of Troy, the consumer products company, not, you know, Helen of Troy, surged 12.6% today. The owner of Braun and OXO Brands posted stronger than expected first quarter earnings and raised its full year outlook for 2019. Procter & Gamble, though, rolled down 1.8%. Bond prices fell. When that happens, the yield goes up. 2.85% is the 10-year. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A couple of months ago, the Supreme Court opened the door to legalized sports betting in this country everywhere, not just in Vegas. So lawmakers in more than a couple of states are working on ways they can get into the game, as it were, and they are thinking, those lawmakers, digital economy, not just boring old casinos. There's big money in gambling apps for developers and gaming companies in the states as well, but there is also some peril. From the Marketplace Hub at WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, Adrian Ma has more.
For decades, the only place where you could legally bet on a basketball or football game was in Nevada. And to do it, you had to go to a casino sportsbook. Basically, it's a room where bettors sit in big, cushy seats, watch games on dozens of panoramic screens, and check out giant digital billboards to calculate how much they can win or lose on each matchup. Kelly Stewart has spent hours of her life in rooms like this, and that's because she's a professional sports bettor.
College football season, I have no life. I'm working 65 hours a week.
Call it gambling if you want, but Stewart says there is a method to it. You have to do your research.
And you need to be disciplined. And as long as you're on the winning side more than you're on the losing side, you're making money.
Even though she lives in Vegas, Stewart says she doesn't go to casinos much anymore. That's the sound of a finger tapping on the screen of a smartphone. I know. Terrible for radio, but great for the professional gambler, living in the one place where mobile sports betting has been legal and available for several years.
It doesn't make any sense for me to drive all the way around town to bet when you could just literally do it at the palm of your hand.
Betting is no different than almost every other consumer activity.
Chris Grove is with the gaming research firm Eilers & Krejcik. He says app developers that already have relationships with casinos are well positioned for the trend. And of course, so are the casinos and online sportsbooks taking the bets. Grove figures if all 50 states legalized it, sports betting operators would get nearly $16 billion a year in revenue, with at least half that coming from mobile.
You're going to have a far larger market.
Which means more tax revenue for states. So, is this a good thing?
Cautious, I think is the word I would use.
Richard James is a psychology researcher at the University of Nottingham in the UK, where mobile sports betting is legal. He says gambling on a phone is different than doing it at a casino, because our phones are always with us.
It can be a very powerful tool to get people to gamble more frequently and perhaps more than they might wish to at times.
This idea that phones can make gambling more habitual has some advocates worried. The Problem Gambling Network of Ohio estimates 1 in 4 adults who gamble are at risk of sports betting addiction.
Hi, Brian.
Yeah.
Hi, Adrian.
Nice to meet you, Adrian.
Nice to meet you.
Come on in.
Brian Borshak was one of them. At his home in North Ridgeville, Ohio, he shows me a memento from his gambling days. He pulls out a small plastic rectangle, a player's card from a casino he used to frequent.
They had entry level and bronze and gold and I got the diamond level, which is kind of ironic, but
what does the diamond level mean?
It means you gamble way too much, in my eyes.
By the time he got treatment for his problem, he says he'd lost over $50,000 betting on sports and owed $100,000 to creditors. In Ohio, there is talk of legalizing sports betting, and Borshak says he's concerned if people can do it on their phones, more may be at risk for addiction.
It creates the opportunity for more problem gambling, because, you know, just like me, I started casually.
By law, 2% of Ohio casino tax revenues, or about $5 million last year, went to programs aimed at treating or preventing gambling addiction. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
We do economic indicators, economic statistics, economic reports a lot on this program, and we get it. Sometimes it can all be a little much. Good thing, then, that we've got a series tailor-made for that dilemma. Your questions, our answers, a little thing we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's query comes to us from Melanie Cost Young. She's in Jacksonville, Florida.
I'm wondering which regularly reported economic data are the most reliable predictors of future economic performance.
With the necessary caveat that past performance is no guarantee of future results, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
As a proud economy nerd, I love Melanie's question. And there is a lot of economic data to wade through.
Really strong jobs report just moments ago.
CPI year on year coming in 2.2%, bang in line with estimates and higher.
January's numbers come in lower. The net is a loss of 15,000.
So what matters most? I asked some of my go-to economists. Betsy Stevenson served as chief economist in the Labor Department under President Obama. She now teaches at the University of Michigan. Which stats does she check on a more or less daily basis?
There are 10 really important ones.
So here they are. Gross domestic product, gross domestic income.
Non-farm payrolls, the unemployment rate, initial unemployment claims. So those are the weekly claims.
Consumer and business confidence.
Inflation, looking at the CPI, employment cost index.
And finally, the S&P 500. Now, you might have noticed that four of Stevenson's top stats track employment or the likelihood that businesses will hire. Those measures are important because when people have jobs and can find jobs easily, it drives more consumer spending, home construction, auto production, vacation travel. But Stevenson says the monthly job numbers and unemployment rate tend to be lagging indicators. They take a while to catch up to how well or poorly the economy's actually doing.
So even when things start slowing down, you know, people like their employees, they don't immediately start laying people off. They think, well, gee, there's a chance things might turn out well.
Brad McMillan, chief investment officer at Commonwealth Financial Network, puts the various employment reports at the top of his stat list, too, along with consumer confidence. But McMillan says when you hear the jobs report, don't focus on the short term.
We get a lot of headlines on the month-to-month numbers. They don't matter as much. What matters is the change on a year-to-year basis. When that drops below about 2 million, it signals we have trouble ahead.
Employers have added more than 2.3 million jobs in the past 12 months. I asked labor economist Aparna Matter at the American Enterprise Institute how she tracks the economy's performance. She pays close attention to wage growth, long-term unemployment, and labor underutilization. That's people working part-time because they can't find full-time jobs. And she wants to know more about the spread of labor-saving technology.
We have studies suggesting that robots are replacing workers in certain industries at a fast pace. So if I could look ahead to the future of work, then I would try to construct some measure of job displacement through automation.
That's an economic statistic we don't have yet. Stay tuned. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We need your questions for this whole thing to work, so hook us up. About what, business and economics-wise, have you always wondered? Let us know at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which I will preface with this completely disheartening fact. Student loan debt in this economy, as we have been reporting, is somewhere north of $1.3 trillion. So think about that while I tell you this. True TV has a new game show it's going to air starting tomorrow. It's called Paid Off. If you win, the grand prize could be getting all your student loans paid off, which is great and awareness raising, yes. But also, I don't think game shows are the answer. All right, we got to go. Fine start to the week on Wall Street. 320 points to the good for the Dow, 1 3/10%. NASDAQ, rather, up 67 points, 8/10%. S&P 500 gained 24 points, 8/10% there as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Colin Risdon. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.